Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, your genial host, and today we'll be doing Appendix 11 of James Mason's Siege. It's not too long. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also at alexlinder.com at some point. 11 Appendix 2, or Appendix 2, and they have it as essentially chapter 11 in the book. NSLF 11.1, the National Socialist Liberation Front. Again, remember, this is an appendix. As an alternative to the lack of any pure education on the National Socialist worldview to members of the National Socialist community, we have established the National Socialist Liberation Front. The primary purpose of the NSLF is to fill in this void by educating a select group of white persons already committed to the National Socialist worldview in the hopes that they will gain a better understanding of Adolf Hitler's National Socialism in relation to today's contemporary political situation. Not being a part of a mass movement organization and not attempting to build a mass movement will allow us to put forth our efforts only to those we feel will benefit from our teachings. This is necessary in so much as it will glue us a higher quality of person with which to work with. Feeling glue may be another word. Maybe the OCR got spat out the wrong word there. It will be from those people from which we will choose who we wish to go join us in taking up arms in a guerrilla war that will surely have to be waged against the system and certain other enemies of the National Socialist Revolution. We will choose those who will associate with us. This organization is not open to anyone. We are clandestine National Socialist guerrillas. We realize what is wrong in America, and we realize what has to be done, but first we must learn all there is to learn about ourselves and our enemies. Without this knowledge, all attempts at waging war shall end in defeat. Sounds a little Sun Tzu there, doesn't it? NSLF program. Members of the NSLF tend to be the more radical and better educated among those involved in the National Socialist movement. Because of the nature of those in NSLF, there is no need to fill illusions of governmental takeovers and world domination. The primary theme of thought in NSLF is to face the many political realities in America and analyze them. Our conclusions will determine our strategy and tactics. NSLF has four primary purposes. One, the maintenance of a political bunk store, or bookstore. There seem to be an unusual number of misread words in here. I don't know what a political bunk store would be, so I'll have to say it's supposed to be a bookstore. The maintenance of a political bookstore dealing primarily in National Socialist thought. Two, militant radical workshops and the training of a cadre of dedicated, well-educated National Socialist revolutionaries will be the end product of an intensive program by which all members will gain a thorough understanding of what National Socialism meant and how best to serve the National Socialist movement through the vehicle of the National Socialist Liberation Front. Radical militant street action aimed at bringing the system and its bosses to their knees is the final goal. This policy of confrontation politics will be achieved by any means necessary. Three, the maintenance of a radical hotline telephone message service. Again, you can tell this is pre-internet. Four, the dissemination of our propaganda. So a bookshop, workshops, a hotline telephone, and dissemination of propaganda would be the fourth. Continuing the fourth, the NSLF will grow, but that growth must be based on facing the political realities of today, We must allow our growth to be organic and must not view our lack of growth as a setback, but rather a primary and necessary tactic for such a unique effort as ours. Again, I'm guessing they did optical character recognition on the text and then edited it, but the editing is really falling apart in this part. Last I'm going to say, but if I stumble, that's probably why. It's noticeably worse in this Appendix 11 than anywhere else, at least in the first couple of pages. We must strive for quality, not the masses of idiots which would only drag us down into insignificance. The crack of gunfire is the only reality the masses care to pay any attention to. The revolution belongs to only to those who are prepared to suffer the consequences of disrupting the silence of darkness. We must prepare to seize the time. Participation in the activities of the National Socialist Liberation Front is limited only to members of the NSLF. In order to become a member of the National Socialist Liberation Front, one must fill out completely a membership application. All questions must be answered in detail. The individual, in addition to the membership application form, must also sign the statement we will provide swearing they are not members of a government agency attempting to infiltrate the NSLF, and that their interest in joining the organization is purely to advance the cause of Adolf Hitler's National Socialism, and that their interest is not to do harm to NSLF or its members. They must understand that to sign such a statement, knowing that their intentions are against the interest of NSLF, will constitute breach of contract and will allow us to take legal action against such individuals. Membership is further restricted to members of the non-Jewish white race. Each applicant and member is subject to an intense investigation to ensure the goodness of their intentions in the minds of the NSLF leadership. The leadership will be the sole deciding factor on who will be allowed membership in NSLF. The National Socialist Liberation Front leadership will also decide who will be expelled and for what reason. The leadership will also be the only ones to decide what the activities of the organization will consist of. A membership application fee of $5 will be required, with a minimum monthly pledge of $5 or more. The money is used to maintain the facilities of NSLF and to finance its activities and publish our propaganda. A member of the NSLF is entitled to attend and participate in our weekly radical forums. Members will also receive the bi-monthly internal bulletin of the NSLF, Siege. Quote, "He not busy being born is busy dying." I think that was a statement Tomasi made, he said earlier, or repeated wherever it originated. That was 11.1. 11.2, Strategy for Revolution. Joseph Tomasi beneath that, so I guess he wrote this. On March 2, 1974, 43 National Socialist revolutionaries met in a hall in El Monte, California. At the meeting, the National Socialists declared their lack of faith in the losing strategy of the mass movement idea. Again, 1974. Spring of 1974, 43, declared their lack of faith in the mass movement idea. The National Socialists abandoned the mass strategy and adopted the revolutionary concept of the guerrilla underground. Bullet point. No longer would we think in terms of obtaining political power through the electorate, but instead of hurting the enemy through force and violence, we would build the armed struggle. Bullet, we would no longer adhere to a mass strategy, but would instead cultivate those already committed to the National Socialist worldview. We have limited ourselves to only the best among movement people. Next point, bullet, we have abandoned petty bourgeois bureaucratic hang-ups and have developed the idea that the end justifies the means. What works is good. Bullet, we recognize that women have played a vanguard role in most revolutionary efforts and involved them in every aspect of NSLF. Bullet, we recognize the fact that the masses of whites will never rally around radical politics. White people no longer have the ability to even recognize the enemy, so how could movement adherents think the masses could ever involve themselves in revolution? The white masses don't recognize their enemies, they don't even care, and they don't have the guts to shed their bourgeois hang-ups. Final bullet. We view armed struggle as the only effective means of forcing political change. Picking up the text proper again. The white man has lost. We are an occupied people in our own land who must now develop a totally different outlook on revolution. We must build the underground. We are making it an effective, hard-hitting National Socialist Revolutionary Army. We have already begun to launch armed assaults against the enemy. More assaults will continue, whether the enemy be the right-wing reactionaries, the system, or the communists. National Socialist ideological and political training, additional training in guerrilla warfare, explosives and demolition, military assault weapons and gas warfare, along with electronic communications and electronic surveillance techniques, are taking place. Classes in first aid, police evasion, techniques of being a POW, and escape are also taking place. The NSLF is divided into combat units. A combat unit consists of 3 liberation fighters and a unit leader. No one combat unit knows who constitutes another combat unit. An NSLF combat unit member is trained as an efficient guerrilla fighter dedicated to destroying the enemy, no matter who that enemy may be. On the surface, he has no uniform. He could be the bearded long hair sitting next to you on the bus, or the clean-cut store clerk. He could be anyone, anywhere. The NSLF has the best elements gathered together from the past 20 years of National Socialist activity in the United States. It has gathered experienced communications experts, military firearms experts, along with the finest liberation fighters available. Each member understands the new concept, the new strategy and tactics needed in order to effect political change. No longer willing to play the games of movement bureaucracies or associating with bald-headed idiots who have no concept of realities, the NSLF will undoubtedly emerge the vanguard fighters in the National Socialist Revolution. Building the Revolutionary Party. Political power stems from the barrel of a gun. That was a Mao quote, actually, though not attributed here. Winning the hearts and minds of the people takes intense organizing activity and a willingness on the part of the people to get involved and be organized. Both at this time do not exist. Since a mass movement cannot be pulled off in America because of the anti-mass movement nature of the American people, which stems from their ever-growing apathy, the only recourse for National Socialist revolutionaries is to go underground and build their own armed struggle to wage war against the state. National Socialist activities have never produced one significant political result in the USA. Any mob resistance our people have ever been engaged in has always been spontaneous eruption, like Boston, with the participation and agitation of no political party or National Socialist act. They did it themselves and without our help. And I must pause here to note that they're kind of going against revolutionary theory, because the same Mao they just quoted above without attributing to him said that, you know, the revolutionary fish needs the people as a sea to swim in. And that means people sympathetic provide the sea, because they're not going to turn you in, and they basically agree with what you're saying. But then he just gets through saying that people don't want to get organized and involved, so they are not a sympathetic, so there is no sea. So they're just as much among the enemy, among the people they ostensibly represent, as if they're doing overt legal political activity. That's one problem that I observe with this. Back to the text. Organizationally, the movement has failed to exploit the opportunities available to create mass mob violence against the enemy, even when such opportunities have lingered on. Publicity stunts have always supplanted effective political action. There has been no arming the students, no burning of school buses except by mobs totally disconnected with National Socialism, no organization of mass violent demonstration, and no effort to communicate with the people and provide the necessary National Socialist political leadership to gain direct National Socialist successes. In Boston, I guess they're talking about the school busing was a huge thing up there in the Irish or the Southie type that you often see kind of denigrated in Jewish films. We're very much opposed to it. But the upper Irish, the more the lace curtain types or the Kennedys and whatever, sold them out. In Boston, contrary to the claims of the old party, the people rejected the party and, if anything, desired help from the Ku Klux Klan and embarrassment for the party. This situation occurred because of a complete lack of proper leadership and leadership activity on the part of the party. The party, with their stagnant Prussian tactics, were incapable of identifying with the revolutionary youth. Special propaganda and mass organizing did not occur. Just a few stunts for the newspapers and no solutions for the problems of the people. As National Socialist revolutionaries, we must always keep in mind that nothing we do against the system can ever be conceived as adventuristic. Militant struggle is the key to heightening the contradictions. It not only strikes concrete blows against the state, but also builds revolutionary consciousness among those involved in the struggle, which is what must happen before we can attempt to build our outside power bases from which to operate while building a popular base of support. Building a popular base of support will become more of a necessity and an easier goal to achieve as conditions in the country become worse and worse. Our greatest weakness is our belief in our weakness. We have to communicate to all National Socialist revolutionaries our strength, and to show them our strength, we have to show them the strength of fighting. We must build confidence within the entire movement before we can hope to help people and lead those people in revolution. That confidence must be based on the idea that, as National Socialist revolutionaries, we cannot be stopped by anyone, the systems, the Reds, or the reaction. This confidence must project the image and reality that only confrontation, politics, force and violence can change the anti-white actions of our enemies. There's use of anti-white long ago. Only by fighting by any means necessary will we be able to effect political change. We cannot effect political change by projecting a phony, bureaucratic Prussian image and constantly spouting unrealistic daydreams, such as imagining the masses would ever wish to emulate stormtroopers. It just won't happen. All revolutions, the actual assumption of power, are instigated by the efforts of a tiny few. Those who could possibly participate in such a revolution among the white people in America are not like those who participated in past European struggles. Americans tend to go against the grain on practically anything. We are not Europeans and won't respond as Europeans. If a revolution occurs in America, it will most likely be a violent one sparked by one lone incident and not by a prepared dialogue of political euphemisms. Until that one lone incident occurs, white people will never flock to the voting booths to place their physical support to the direction of helmeted stormtroopers. They will instead continue to play the present Republican and Democrat party politics, no matter how bad things get, simply because of their complete apathy towards getting involved with their neighbors' problems. They don't recognize those problems as their own. The old party could not offer any proof of their ability to provide solutions to the problems facing the country, especially when the party had only one or two real leaders. With such a situation, how could the party make claims of having the answer? Their past performances give no guiding light at this time. NSLF believes that it is necessary to begin development of an armed struggle immediately. We now understand the futility of maintaining the fight for social change within the framework of civil debate. Instead of trying to educate and organize people who don't see it our way, We write them off as enemies and neutralizers of the National Socialist Revolution. This has marked the ascendancy of the purely militant point of view in NSLF thinking. We now confine our outreach to the small group of movement people we consider potentially militant National Socialist revolutionaries. The NSLF feels that since these National Socialists already know that the system sucks, all they need is a revolutionary example in order to move into armed struggle themselves. The NSLF will lead these National Socialists through a series of rigidly defined steps from the lowest levels of armed struggle to the highest levels. These levels are determined by the violence of the weapons used. Rocks and trashing are on one level, Molotov cocktails are higher, and bombs are higher still. The highest level is, of course, guns. This tactic of levels includes no political guidelines or flexibility and almost completely disregards mass participation. Levels are defined solely in terms of the weapons used. A mass action involving hundreds using only rocks is defined as a lower level of struggle than a bombing carried out by a few. Leadership in the struggle has to do with making things happen. Leadership is the people who are doing it, cutting through diversionary debate, smashing forms and familiarities that hold us back, and through developing and acting on a clear line of how we move to win, redefining the context, content, and meaning of the National Socialist movement and the revolution. That's what we call seizing the time. NSLF is building an underground army. We must spread our efforts to trouble spots in the country, exploiting racially troubled areas and establishing bases of support. At these times, we will continue to fan the fires as long as we can, using this chaos to launch armed attacks against the enemy. Since our militance is obviously going to lead to a military confrontation, probably with a U.S. Army that is growing ever blacker, maybe not for the next few years, then the fact that most of the movement has no consistency of armaments makes us fools. So we must build internally during the next few months. Therefore, we should state publicly that we believe in, support, and are preparing for armed struggle, for that is what we must win to effect political change. In times of revolution, just wars and wars of liberation, we must love the angels of destruction and disorder as opposed to the devils of conservatism and law and order. To hell with all those who block the revolution with rhetoric. Revolutionary rhetoric or counter-revolutionary rhetoric. We will not make our most eloquent statement in courtrooms and at press conferences, but in the streets of Jew capitalist America. The choice of weapons belongs to him who moves, and NSLF moves into the streets, and we have made our choice of weapons and tactics. The weapon of criticism will never equal the criticism of weapons. NSLF prefers a paralyzed enemy to a well-criticized one. Those who can't stand the sight of blood, especially their own, should stay home and pray for those who come outside the master's rules to move, to do it, and pray for victory and not an end to the slaughter. Pray for us to succeed, for if we do succeed, you will be safe. If we don't, then kiss the baby goodbye. And that was Joseph Tomasi. Terrorism. By Perry Warthen, W-A-R-T-H-A-N, Perry Warthen, Universal Order. Universal Order was what Mason founded, the name given him by Charles Manson after he had begun talking to Charles Manson, communicating with him. So it's post-NSLF. So 11.3, Terrorism, by Perry Warthen of Universal Order. The pros and cons of terrorism have long been debated among revolutionaries from all sectors of political thought. When I was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, called Wobblies was their nickname, a big thing in the turn of the century, 1900s. And when I was a member of the IWW in the mid-70s, the Wobblies, there was division between sabotage and general strike. The IWW, like the National Socialists, had their high day decades ago, and likewise both generally continue to cling to past ideas. When the IWW had millions in its ranks, a general strike could have crippled the system. You may recall that the Tsar of Russia was overthrown by a general strike. However, with the membership currently at about 600, a general strike called by the IWW would look about as promising as a couple of stormtroopers leafleting the White House and calling for a white workers' revolution. Sabotage, on the other hand, required few people who, with organization, could cripple the system, or at least make their demands felt. The system in the mid-30s outlawed the IWW, and everyone with a union card was soon in jail. The lesson was this: a terrorist organization cannot be a public organization. The Irish Republican Army, as an example, IRA, on the other hand, remains secret as it remains effective. Well, they have an above ground and a below ground. Well, they would be the below ground part. It keeps the demand for a free Ireland alive. As soon as England decides that the price being exacted by the IRA for Northern Ireland is too much to continue to pay, they will end up turning it over to the Irish Republic. The Irish Republic does not condone the IRA. They do this in order to maintain peace between themselves and England. Otherwise, England might attack IRA bases in Ireland just the way Israel does with Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, bases in Lebanon and other Mideast nations. Let us compare the Irish Republic with today's legalistic National Socialist parties and the IRA with America's future white terrorists. The overground parties, or above-ground parties, will continue to denounce the terrorists, though they will benefit from their labor when victory has been secured. It's only proper that they should do this, as the overground membership are not terrorists by nature, and there would be no point inviting system wrath down upon innocent, unsuspecting heads. Make no error, however, when terrorism comes alive in America as a group activity, the legal overground parties will suffer losses in both jailed members and in dropouts. When the system demands blood, the legals will suffer along with the captured terrorists, even though these legals may be pacifist. Just as today's Canadian comrades who are jailed for 2 years for teaching that the gas 6 million, quote-unquote, is pure myth. Such injustice only spurs the terrorist and adds to his numbers. The common white man in Canada probably doesn't even know of these injustices resulting from Canada's ratification of the genocide law, or, if he does, he could care less. After all, he's having fun watching Gary Coleman growing up on TV. That would be a reference to Different Strokes. What you talking about, Willis? If a Canadian blows up a Canadian police station, however, the news reaches 60 million viewers that week. Thus, the cost of one bomb equals 60 million leaflets, which the movement could neither produce nor distribute. Terrorism is good economics. When the public hears that the White Liberation Front has bombed the Toronto police station, demanding the release of a certain number of political prisoners serving terms for their use of free speech, the public is at once informed, and this information could not have been more cheaply spread or more quickly. So it's kind of a twofer, I guess you could say. With the terrorism, you get the lanyap, the thrown-in free gift. Like if you bought a $5,000 bracelet, the jewelry store owner might throw in a pair of nice pearl earrings for your girlfriend you're buying it for, right? As a lanyap, a French word. So if you have the balls and the ability to scheme and plan and get away with an act of terrorism, or even if you don't, get away with it. You get the publicity for free. And it's far more cheap in terms of money than it would be if you tried to print up 60 million leaflets. It would be thrown away or ignored by the system, in which you couldn't afford to print anyway, is what he's saying. He says, I use the name White Liberation Front in this article to suggest reality. Future terrorists are, of course, free to adopt any name they choose, so long as it denotes unity of all white forces. Its originators could have been an NS section, a Klan section, or what have you. But in no case would I hope that its use would be adopted by those who merely print one or more of the same old newsletters and operate out of P.O. boxes. Publishers should not set policy because they lack the warriors to carry it out. True terrorists are warriors, and it is up to the New York Times, Time Magazine, etc., to print their demands for them. It is a waste of time for those without warriors to vainly call for them. The WLF, by any name, is coming to America. So far, the only diehard actual terrorists we've seen have been Puerto Ricans demanding independence, and that was back in like the 50s, I think that was. They tried to take over Congress. Few will remember that. But like the cockroach, they never seem to die out. Just when you think you've got them all, you find you're reinfested again. Like the IRA, they don't go away. Sooner or later, the tenant must move out and turn the house over to the roaches. So far, the white right has only had lone eagles such as Franklin, Spizak, Cowan, Long, etc. The public soon gets over the lone bigot, but they fear the group, for the well-organized group, like the roaches, does not go away. The Symbionese Liberation Army, and Patty Hearst, this was a very big deal in the 70s for a while. Symbionese Liberation Army, it was that supposedly kidnapped her, and then she was won over to its side in one of the first uses of the Stockholm Syndrome. That's where I think that may even have come from. The Symbionese Liberation Army was small, too small to survive, and its organization was all wrong. The WLF would be best built on, quote, 3+1. Three privates and one unit leader, whose only contact with a group leader. Let me redo that. The WLF would be best built on 3+1. Three privates and one unit leader, whose only contact with a group leader who heads three units. Who's the only contact with a group leader who heads three units. So, three privates and one leader, and the leader of those three is the only one who's in contact with the group leader, and the group leader heads three units. Likewise, three groups are headed by a lieutenant who only needs to know his own three group leaders, and captain, who is over three lieutenants. So it's kind of a pyramid structure based on three and one. Note that three units are equal to one group, three groups equal to one platoon, 40 men counting the lieutenant, three platoons equal to one company with one captain, 121 men. This system of 3+1 can be employed right up to the Corps and Army level. In the above arrangement, there wouldn't be any captains without troops, unlike today's Hollywooders, which have more officers than troopers. The Lone Eagles could be one-man units and still use the WLF label. Successful Lone Eagles could end up unit leaders as they selectively recruit others by their acts of devotion. Unsuccessful Lone Eagles who recruit feds or finks can use their hindsight to educate others, as I myself do now. The wise man will learn from the mistakes of others. Thus, the WLF will be built by those who suffer success. Remember that survival is of the fittest. Revolutionary Darwinism. The Army of God is a new group, too new to judge its success. They fight abortion by blowing up abortion clinics. Also, their threat to blow up a judge has not been taken lightly. While some terrorists do not telegraph their shots, some do. Of course, there are cranks, too. Many snakes rattle their tails against leaves, but everyone respects a true rattlesnake. "Don't tread on me" was once an American Revolutionary slogan, and it was no bluff. The Boston Tea Party was a form of terrorist theater. Likewise, if the WLF painted the Statue of Liberty red, perhaps using an old-fashioned crop duster, and called the New York Times with a message, "The whole national government is red, so we thought that the great lady needed to be red too," would it not be the same? Would it not get the message out? For those with a sense of humor but no stomach for violence, this form of action could help fill a few units of the WLF. Some will favor non-homicidal violence, like the Army of God, while others will want to go all the way. No team is bound by the policy of any other. All are independent operators. Later, when mass coordination is needed and the WLF is built up to a large organization, teams and groups can share operations. Voice graph analyzers can spot spies. Truth serum can reveal all they know. It wouldn't be surprising if the WLF began mailing the heads of uncovered finks to their federal bosses. Hitler said that terror could only be fought with terror. If my peek into the future troubles the weak hearts of those parties who claim they can win at the ballot box, yet never run any candidates for office, it is rightly so. When terrorism by whites becomes a true menace to the system, then Big Brother will begin locking them up today en masse. There's no today in there. When terrorism by whites becomes a true menace to the system, then Big Brother will begin locking them up en masse. This will become educational for many of today's leaders, quote unquote. I suspect they'll maintain an entire prison block just for commanders alone. Chicken-hearted members will run. Still others will cooperate with the system. Everyone's true colors will be known to all. Bad publicity may be the best night of the long knives of all. In all fairness, many of today's booksellers will be made into martyrs once we get the Canadian type of anti-hate laws and these same people continue to publish or sell. A WLF demand for their release after a bombing of an FBI office will reach more TV viewers than all the books and leaflets produced by all of the legal above-ground groups since 1945. For one of the main goals of terrorism is to get your message heard. Here's injustice. Here's revenge. Here's the solution. To ignore the solution brings more injustice, which, in turn, causes more revenge. Countermeasures by the system will only serve to heighten further attacks by the WLF. Such is the fuel of revolution. When the public gets tired of fear, they concede something to the terrorist. In England, it will be Northern Ireland. In America, it could easily be racially segregated zones. It might mean the release of political prisoners, and these, along with the other terrorist leaders, could participate in the governments of these zones. Of course, these free zones, just like Northern Ireland, will have to be established for the masses to enjoy at the WLF's cost, as the WLF will most likely continue to fight in other areas for ultimate white liberation everywhere. What of the terrorist himself? St. Paul said in the New Testament that it was best not to marry, but to remain unmarried like him. However, this was no command from God, but only some advice. The reason Paul wrote this was because he was, at the time, a prisoner because of his religious or political activities. He was advising those of his day that they should expect the same and not to commit others, unless they were two others, unless they were fully prepared to share the same fate. One cannot expect to be a revolutionary and not be jailed. One cannot be a revolutionary and expect to lead a normal existence. This does not rule out a family, but it does rule it out in the commonly accepted sense. Families can also be used by the system as bait and as hostages, leverage, etc., against the revolutionary. Hence, it is probably best that a WLF member remain single, at least in the eyes of the state, and women who desire an active role in terrorism against the system cannot afford to have dependent children. Movement morality must be fitted to the person and specialties of the operations involved. Some may want to rob a supermarket the day after payday, netting around $70,000, and then finance other greater operations. Some may decide to become as Wolfpacks. Wolfpackers are rumored to be in existence today, a secret society of wolves in sheep's clothes, posing as liberal renegades, miscegenators, etc., to lure victims to a sudden disappearance. The idea is said to have originated with the pseudo-gangs of Africa at the time the British were fighting the Mau Mau. They looked black, chemicals on the skin and eyes, talked black, and smelled black, captured clothes. The Mau Mau never knew the difference until they were shot in the back. One could only think of what half a dozen or so pseudo-Jew wolfpackers could do in Hollywood society, etc. The WLF will not play by system rules, including those agreed to by legalistic parties. Ever since entering prison, I've met many who claim to have shot blacks on those occasions when, first, they were there, and second, it looked like they could get away with it. If true, the reaction of those discovering the bodies must have been that they were killed by other blacks. Consider if these had been lone eagles and had deposited WLF notes on the corpses. It would appear, and be in reality, as an overnight wave of racial killings, and the system and media outcry would be fantastic. Blacks would stay on their own side of town for a time. There would be a demand for a legal crackdown. Blacks would counter with more zebra-type groups. That was a group little publicized in Northern California around San Francisco that killed a whole bunch of whites in the 70s. Don't hear about that much today. The races would polarize and the respective peoples would come together for common defense. Remember the Red Leg and Jayhawkers wars in Missouri and Kansas before the Civil War? The Red Legs ran the anti-slavers out of Missouri, and the Jayhawkers ran the slavers out of Kansas. Political power is gunpowder. Don't let anyone tell you different. Ballots are only a replacement for guns, and when the ballot box does not serve someone, they fight with guns. Martin Luther King was a pacifist, but his marches caused violence, including his own death, which in turn caused blacks to burn many American cities. When American whites get the spirit and organize, as the Klan did after the Civil War in the South, the WLF will be born. The WLF will need public support, and, like the first era Klan, 33-1, some call it, they will use their loot to help widows and indebted farmers, etc., as well as to run out the modern-day carpetbaggers. They will kill top JDL leaders, as they will kill all enemies, Jew, black, and traitor whites, who side against their own people. If the system tries to black out the news, the people will demand to know what's going on. Why has the Statue of Liberty been painted red? With a strong nationwide WLF, the murder of a mixed couple will cause the reaction that miscegenation is a bad risk. The following generation will know that it just isn't done. Consider a mixed marriage in Northern Ireland today, a target for both sides. By the year 2000, terrorism will include atomic bombs, chemical as well as germ warfare. The successful terrorist group will be the one which bars no device and which is proficient in all. The Spizaks, Franklins, and Matthews will be remembered for their moderate and humane treatment and style. The do-nothing, go-nowhere approach of today's overground groups are driving more people into becoming lone eagles for lack of any short-term victory since Rockwell's days. Since the commander's death 15 years ago, the NS movement has done nothing but divide and subdivide into smaller and smaller parties, all of which do little more than bicker and quarrel with one another. Only one national group, the National Socialist Liberation Front of Joseph Tomasi's creation, has claimed an underground section, part of which is in Canada, I expect. I'll tell you that things are going to change in the next 15 years, or else you can kiss your white baby goodbye, for it will have become brown. The other white movements are doing little better. Now is the time to organize for the future. Canada today is America tomorrow. When they outlaw you, you'll either be an outlaw or you'll be nothing. If printing is all you can do, then print. But be prepared to go to jail for it. At least you'll be a point of injustice the WLF can protest. Terrorists often become known and cannot always hide in a basement. In later stages, WLF teams and groups will hide in wilderness areas, always on the move, and they will sometimes fight hit-and-run engagements with the mongrelized U.S. Army. This will be a first since the Civil War and will certainly set the stage for open war. Let us consider also a Russian invasion. Will you prefer to fight a join to some mixed American freedom fighters? The WLF must maintain its independence at all costs. A Russian invasion would only help us win our territory and gain more sympathy with the general public. On the other hand, a war in which this country fought in the defense of Israel would put us in the traitor class, except in the eyes of those few who saw the error of such a military sham on the part of, quote, our government. In the end, the WLF may need to come out of the wilderness and into normal combat. This will require a general race war already in progress and reaching into the ranks of the armed forces. I can't predict everything, but I can promise you that if you want a free and white America, or even a piece of it, it is going to be a long and dirty fight. Therefore, I suggest you'd best be prepared. And that's its conclusion, and then a parenthesis. This essay was issued by the Universal Order as a special supplement to Siege. And that was appendix number 11 from a guy named Worthen, whom perhaps he was I'm not familiar with the name, but it sounds like from the way he was writing, he may have been a Canadian. He's saying what happens in Canada today will happen in the U.S. tomorrow. Anyway, thanks for being with me today. I'll be back with you again real, real soon, and we'll pick up with the last couple of appendices to James Mason's Siege.